This is the High Roads Media production of the revised and updated 75th anniversary edition of The Law of Success, Volume 2. Written by Napoleon Hill and read by Mario Rosales. The Law of Success, revised and updated, Volume 2. Napoleon Hill and the Napoleon Hill Foundation. Edited by Bill Hartley, Arthur Morey, and Matthew Sartwell. The Principles of Personal Power, Initiative and Leadership, Imagination, Enthusiasm, Self-Control. Publisher's Note: Napoleon Hill first popularized his philosophy of personal achievement in a series of lectures. His success as a public speaker led to the publication of his basic concepts in a number of editions with slightly differing formats. Finally, in 1928, the material was assembled in book form and was published as The Law of Success. In issuing this revised and updated edition of Volume 2, The Law of Success, we have drawn upon all materials and editions published under that title. Where there was a repetition of ideas, we selected the most comprehensive. We have also included some marginal notes that illustrate Hill's points with more modern examples. All new material that has been added to the original text will be clearly identified in this recording as commentary from the editors. Finally, and this is the most delicate issue, we have treated the text itself as we would the text of a living author. When we felt that something was obscure or misleading because the author's language was idiosyncratic or archaic, we have made minor changes. It has been our intention to be both true to the text and true to the man who constantly refined and clarified his ideas. In short, we have attempted to allow Napoleon Hill to be as modern an author as if he were still among us. The Publisher. Preface to the second volume. Congratulations! By purchasing The Principles of Personal Power, the second volume in The Law of Success, you have made an important commitment to yourself and your pursuit of your dream. You have demonstrated that you feel comfortable with what you've learned from Volume 1 and are ready to tackle 4 new lessons. It may help you to consider the lessons that you've learned in Volume 1 of The Law of Success as an effort to gain control of your immediate situation. You learn to form a mastermind with a few close associates to pursue a definite aim, and you concentrated on developing your self-confidence throughout. All this was designed to give you the basic skills and resources to begin your quest towards success. In Volume 2 of The Law of Success, you will focus on acquiring behaviors that give you more control over what happens to you in the wider world. You will learn, for instance, to exercise initiative and leadership. By displaying initiative and leadership, you demonstrate that you are ready for more responsibility and opportunity than you currently have. Rest assured that once you have let the world know this, it will provide you with the chance to seize them. You will also find that acting with initiative and leadership fires up your imagination. As you anticipate problems and opportunities, your mind will embrace new ideas, new possibilities that provide you with a chance to move forward, improve your situation, and rise even further above the common crowd of people who are just getting by. Emboldened by initiative, leadership, and imagination, you will discover another valuable asset: enthusiasm. Your enthusiasm will serve you like a dynamo, taking the potential energy of your dreams and ideas and converting them into actions. The actions that you back with the force of your enthusiasm will have an irresistible force, one that sweeps you past obstacles and draws other helpful people to you. And finally, you will come to understand the value of self-control. Self-control is not simply a matter of being able to forego a second helping. It is the ability to choose the thoughts that dominate your mind and determine your actions. Without self-control, you do nothing but respond to the world around you. With self-control, you become a person who shapes that world. As you understand more and more of the Law of Success, you will find that it offers you insight into every activity in your day. Look for opportunities to apply what you have discovered, and you will find that they are everywhere. People who are truly determined to amount to something in life are rare in this world. If you are one of these people, you will discover that doors open for you and possibilities abound. From the smallest, most everyday experience, you will be able to extract benefits that others miss. So, onward to greater understanding and the future that you are creating for yourself. The editor. The author's acknowledgement of help rendered him in the writing of this course. This course is the result of careful analysis of the life work of over 100 men and women who have achieved unusual success in their respective callings. I have spent more than 20 years in gathering, classifying, testing, and organizing the lessons upon which the course is based. In this labor, I have received valuable assistance either in person or by studying the life work of the following: Henry Ford, Thomas A. Edison, Harvey S. Firestone, John D. Rockefeller, Charles M. Schwab, Woodrow Wilson, Darwin P. Kingsley, William Wrigley Jr., A. D. Lasker, E. A. Filene, James J. Hill, Edward Bach, Cyrus H. K. Curtis, George W. Perkins, Henry L. Doherty, George S. Parker, Dr. C. O. Henry, General Rufus A. Ayers, Judge Elbert H. Gary, William Howard Taft, Dr. Elmer Gates, John W. Davis, Captain George M. Alexander, to whom I was formerly an assistant, Hugh Chalmers, Dr. E. W. Strickler, Edwin C. Barnes, Robert L. Taylor, Fiddling Bob, George Eastman, E. M. Statler, Andrew Carnegie, John Wanamaker, Marshall Field, Samuel Gompers, F. W. Woolworth, Judge Daniel T. Wright, one of my law instructors, Elbert Hubbard, Luther Burbank, O. H. Harriman, John Burroughs, E. H. Harriman, Charles P. Steinmetz, Frank Vanderlip, Theodore Roosevelt, William H. French, and Dr. Alexander Graham Bell, to whom I owe credit for most of Lesson 1. Of the people named, perhaps Henry Ford and Andrew Carnegie should be acknowledged as having contributed most toward the building of this course, for the reason that it was Andrew Carnegie who first suggested the writing of the course, and Henry Ford, whose life work supplied much of the material out of which the course was developed. I have studied the majority of these people at close range, in person. With many of them, I enjoy, or did enjoy before their death, the privilege of close personal friendship which enabled me to gather from their philosophy facts that would not have been available under other conditions. With the exception of the psychological law referred to in Lesson 1 as the mastermind, I don't claim to have created anything basically new in this course. What I have done, however, has been to organize old truths and known laws into practical, usable form, where they may be properly interpreted and applied by the workaday person whose needs call for a philosophy of simplicity. The student of this course is warned against passing judgment upon it before having listened to the entire 17 lessons. The listener who takes up this course with an open mind and sees to it that his or her mind remains open until the last lesson is finished will be richly rewarded with a broader and more accurate view of life as a whole. Napoleon Hill. The 17 Laws of Success. Number 1. The Mastermind. Number 2. Definite Chief Aim. Number 3. Self-Confidence. Number 4. Habit of Saving. Number 5. Initiative and Leadership. Number 6. Imagination. Number 7. Enthusiasm. Number 8. Self-Control. Number 9. Habit of Doing More Than Paid For. Number 10. Pleasing Personality. Number 11. Accurate Thinking. Number 12. Concentration. Number 13. Cooperation. Number 14. Profiting by Failure. Number 15. Tolerance. Number 16. Practicing the Golden Rule. And number 17. The Universal Law. Lesson 5. Initiative and Leadership. You can do it if you believe you can. Before you proceed to the mastery of this lesson, your attention is directed to the fact that there is perfect coordination of thought running throughout this course. The entire 17 lessons, 9 through 17 will be in subsequent volumes, harmonize and blend with each other so that they constitute a perfect chain that has been built, link by link, out of the factors that enter into the development of power through organized effort. You will also find that the same fundamental principles of applied psychology form the foundation of each of these 17 lessons, although different application is made of these principles in each of the lessons. This lesson on initiative and leadership comes after the lesson on self-confidence in Volume 1, for the reason that no one could become an efficient leader or take the initiative in any great undertaking without belief in himself. The power of initiative. Initiative and leadership are associated terms in this lesson for the reason that leadership is essential for the attainment of success, and initiative is the very foundation upon which this necessary quality of leadership is built. Initiative is as essential to success as a hub is essential to a wheel. Initiative is that exceedingly rare quality that impels a person to do that which ought to be done without being told to do it. Elbert Hubbard expressed himself on the subject of initiative in these words: "The world bestows its big prizes, both in money and honors, for one thing, and that is initiative." What is initiative? I'll tell you. It is doing the right thing without being told. But next to doing the right thing without being told is to do it when you are told once. That is to say, carry the message to Garcia. Those who can carry a message get high honors, but their pay is not always in proportion. Next, there are those who do the right thing only when necessity kicks them from behind, and these get indifference instead of honors, and a pittance for pay. This kind spends most of the time polishing a bench with the hard luck story. Then, still lower down in the scale than this, we have the person who will not do the right thing even when someone goes along to demonstrate and stays to see that the work is done right. This person is always out of a job and receives deserved contempt, unless there is a rich relative in the background, in which case destiny patiently waits around the corner with the club. To which class do you belong? Inasmuch as you will be expected to take inventory of yourself and determine which of the factors of this course you need most after you have completed the last lesson, it may be well if you begin to ready for this analysis by answering the question that Elbert Hubbard has asked. To which class do you belong? One of the peculiarities of leadership is the fact that it is never found in those who have not acquired the habit of taking the initiative. Leadership is something that you must invite yourself into. It will never thrust itself upon you. If you will carefully analyze all leaders whom you know, you will see that they not only exercised initiative, but they also went about their work with a definite purpose in mind. You will also see that they possess that quality described in the third lesson of this course, self-confidence. These facts are mentioned in this lesson for the reason that it will profit you to observe that successful people make use of all the factors covered by the 17 lessons of the course, and for the more important reason that it will profit you to understand thoroughly the principle of organized effort, which this course is intended to establish in your mind. This seems an appropriate place to state that this course is not intended as a shortcut to success, nor is it intended as a mechanical formula that you may use in noteworthy achievement without effort on your part. The real value of the course lies in the use that you will make of it, and not in the course itself. The chief purpose of the course is to help you develop in yourself the qualities covered by its 17 lessons, and one of the most important of these qualities is initiative, the subject of this lesson. We will now proceed to apply the principle upon which this lesson is founded by describing, in detail, just how it served successfully to complete a business transaction that most people would call. In 1916, I needed $25,000 with which to create an educational institution, but I had neither this sum nor sufficient collateral with which to borrow it through the usual banking sources. Did I bemoan my fate or think of what I might accomplish if some rich relative or good Samaritan would come to my rescue by loaning me the necessary capital? I did nothing of the sort. I did just what you will be advised throughout this course to do. First of all, I made the securing of this capital my definite chief aim. Second, I laid out a complete plan through which to transform this aim into reality. Backed by sufficient self-confidence and spurred on by initiative, I proceeded to put my plan into action. But before the action stage of the plan had been reached, more than 6 weeks of constant, persistent study and effort and thought were embodied in it. If a plan is to be sound, it must be built of carefully chosen material. You will here observe the application of the principle of organized effort through the operation of which it is possible for one to ally or associate several interests in such a way that each of these interests is greatly strengthened and each supports all the others, just as one link in a chain supports all the other links. I wanted this $25,000 in capital for the purpose of creating a school of advertising and salesmanship. Two things were necessary for the organization of such a school. One was the $25,000 capital, which I did not have, and the other was the proper course of instruction, which I did have. My problem was to ally myself with some group who needed that which I had, and who would supply the $25,000. After my plan had been completed, and I was satisfied that it was equitable and sound, I laid it before the owner of a well-known and reputable business college, which just then was finding competition quite keen and was badly in need of a plan for meeting this competition. My plan was presented in about these words: "Whereas you have one of the most reputable business colleges in the city, and whereas you need some plan with which to meet the stiff competition in your field, and whereas your good reputation has provided you with all the credit you need, and whereas I have the plan that will help you meet this competition successfully, be it resolved that we ally ourselves through a plan that will give you that which you need, and at the same time supply me with something which I need." Then I proceed to unfold my plan further in these words: "I have written a very practical course on advertising and salesmanship. Having built this course out of my actual experience in training and directing salesmen, and my experience in planning and directing many successful advertising campaigns, I have back of it plenty of evidence of its soundness. If you will use your credit in helping market this course, I will place it in your business college as one of the regular departments of your curriculum and take entire charge of this newly created department. No other business college in the city will be able to meet your competition, for the reason that no other college has such a course as this. The advertising that you do in marketing this course will serve also to stimulate the demand for your regular business course. You may charge the entire amount that you spend for this advertising to my department, leaving you the accumulative advantage that will accrue to your other departments without cost to you. Now, I suppose you will want to know where I profit by this transaction, and I will tell you. I want you to enter into a contract with me in which it will be agreed that when the cash receipts from my department equal the amount that you have paid out or contracted to pay out for advertising, my department and my course in advertising and salesmanship become my own, and I may have the privilege of separating this department from your school and running it under my own name. The plan was agreeable, and the contract was closed. Please keep in mind that my definite purpose was to secure the use of $25,000, for which I had no security to offer." Editor's Commentary. A powerful example of initiative can be found in one of the greatest modern success stories, the founding of Microsoft by Bill Gates and Paul Allen. Gates and Allen became friends in high school. They were early examples of the now familiar computer nerd, people so obsessed with programming that they seemed to think of little else. In 1974, Gates was attending Harvard while Allen was working for Honeywell and also living in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It was there that they began to exhibit the initiative that would guide their careers. An issue of Popular Electronics magazine had a cover article on a new computer, the Altair 8800. Today, the Altair would seem very primitive. It had no keyboard and was designed to be connected to a teletype. But Gates and Allen knew that it would be tremendously appealing if someone wrote a simple version of the programming language BASIC to give the Altair instructions. For 2 months, they worked on writing BASIC language for the Altair, though they didn't even own one of the machines, and then contacted Ed Roberts, the engineer who had designed the Altair. Their version of BASIC worked, and Roberts was so impressed that he offered Gates and Allen a contract. By the summer, Gates and Allen had formed a company they called Microsoft, which earned royalties on every Altair sold with their language. Soon they were adapting other programming languages for the Altair. Sometimes it seems that when anyone wants to make a point about any aspect of success, they cite Bill Gates and the founding of Microsoft. So what is the point of the story in the context of initiative? It is quite possible to be successful without demonstrating any particular initiative. Some people simply follow the tried-and-true path and become successes. And Bill Gates and Paul Allen were smart enough about computers early on that they surely would have been successful. On the other hand, some people have terrific ideas, but their ideas don't make them successful because they never got beyond using those ideas to amuse themselves and their friends. That, too, could have been the story of Gates and Allen. But it wasn't. And that's where initiative played a huge part in the story. Bill Gates and Paul Allen weren't content to just go along and get along, and they weren't content to wait until someone else told them what a good idea they had. Without initiative, they could have had enough success to satisfy most people. Because they had initiative, however, they stepped up to the plate, thought outside the box, pushed the envelope, and had not just success, but the biggest success ever in the history of the world. Now back to Napoleon Hill's original text. In a little less than a year, the business college had paid out slightly more than $25,000 for advertising and marketing my course and the other expenses incidental to the operation of this newly organized department, while the department had collected and turned back to the college tuition fees equaling the amount the college had spent, and I took the department over as a self-sustaining business, according to the terms of my contract. As a matter of fact, this newly created department not only served to attract students for the other departments of the college, but at the same time, the tuition fees collected through this new department were sufficient to place it on a self-sustaining basis before the end of the first year. Now you can see that while the college did not loan me one penny of actual capital, it nevertheless supplied me with credit, which served exactly the same purpose. I said that my plan was founded upon equity, that it contemplated a benefit to all parties concerned. The benefit accruing to me was the use of the $25,000, which resulted in an established and self-sustaining business by the end of the first year. The benefit accruing to the college was the students secured for its regular commercial and business course as a result of the money spent in advertising my department, all advertising having been done under the name of the college. Today, that business college is one of the most successful schools of its kind, and it stands as a monument of sound evidence with which to demonstrate the value of allied effort. Editor's Commentary. While not perfectly parallel, the story of Hill's College and the story of the rise of Microsoft share the basic principles of Napoleon Hill's Law of Success. In both cases, the entrepreneurs didn't have the money to launch their projects themselves. In both cases, they took the initiative to find someone who did, and then made the case for why it was in that party's interest to finance the project. As Hill has pointed out, once his course had paid back the seed capital, he then owned the business, and it went on to become the most successful college of its kind. To continue the example of Microsoft, in 1980, IBM wanted someone to write the software for a personal computer line they were about to launch that was far more sophisticated than the Altair. They wanted results in just 3 months. Microsoft agreed to do it. Allen and Gates bought an operating system from another company and began adapting it for IBM. It was called MS-DOS, for Microsoft Disk Operating System. They and their staff met IBM's deadline, and the IBM PC caused a sensation. It also inspired an immediate wave of clones, less expensive versions of the IBM PC. Microsoft's deal with IBM allowed them to license their software to whomever they pleased, and that's what they did, riding the huge surge in popularity of home computers. But Microsoft didn't stop there. They created a worldwide sales force to license their software in other countries, and they continually worked to improve MS-DOS. In 4 years, their sales quadrupled. Today, Microsoft dominates the software market worldwide. Is it luck? Were Paul Allen and Bill Gates just in the right place at the right time? Certainly not. From the moment they saw the Altair on the cover of Popular Electronics, they pursued a definite aim, one that continued to grow as time passed. They were determined to make themselves indispensable to the manufacturers and owners of personal computers. Once they had their initial success, they continued to drive themselves and their employees forward to offer further improvement to what they had already done. Microsoft is the leader in the software industry precisely because it has always been willing to take the initiative, and with it, the risks of pursuing its founders' aims. These two stories are told not only because they show the value of initiative and leadership, but they also lead up to the subject covered by the next lesson of this course on the Law of Success, which is imagination. Resuming Napoleon Hill's original text. There are generally many plans for the operation of which a desired object may be achieved, and it often happens to be true that the obvious and usual methods employed are not the best. The usual method of procedure would have been to borrow from a bank. You can see that this method was impractical in this case for the reason that no collateral was available. A great philosopher once said, "Initiative is the passkey that opens the door to opportunity." I do not recall who this philosopher was, but I know that he was great because of the soundness of his statement. We will now proceed to outline the exact procedure that you must follow if you are to become a person of initiative and leadership. Eliminate procrastination. First, you must master the habit of procrastination and eliminate it from your makeup. This habit of putting off until tomorrow that which you should have done last week or last year or a score of years ago is gnawing at the very vitals of your being, and you can accomplish nothing until you throw it off. The method through which you eliminate procrastination is based upon a well-known and scientifically tested principle of psychology that has been referred to in the two preceding lessons in Volume 1 of this course as autosuggestion. Copy the following formula and place it conspicuously in your room where you will see it as you retire at night and as you arise in the morning. Having chosen a definite chief aim as my life work, I now understand it to be my duty to transform this purpose into reality. Therefore, I will form the habit of taking some definite action each day that will carry me one step nearer to the attainment of my definite chief aim. I know that procrastination is a deadly enemy of all who would become leaders in any undertaking, and I will eliminate this habit from my makeup. Number 1. Doing some one definite thing each day, something that ought to be done without anyone telling me to do it. Number 2. Looking around until I find at least one thing that I can do each day that I have not been in the habit of doing and that will be of value to others without expectation of pay. Number 3. Telling at least one other person each day of the value of practicing this habit of doing something that ought to be done without being told to do it. I can see that the muscles of the body have become strong in proportion to the extent which they are used. Therefore, I understand that the habit of initiative also becomes fixed in proportion to the extent that it is practiced. I realize that the place to begin developing the habit of initiative is in the small, commonplace things connected with my daily work. Therefore, I will go at my work each day as if I were doing it solely for the purpose of developing this necessary habit of initiative. I understand that by practicing this habit of taking the initiative in connection with my daily work, I will not only be developing that habit, but I will also be attracting the attention of those who will place greater value on my services as a result of this practice. And here, at the end of the page, you sign your signature to reinforce your commitment to learn this form. Regardless of what you're now doing, every day brings you face to face with a chance to render some service outside of the course of your regular duties that will be of value to others. In rendering this additional service of your own accord, you of course understand that you are not doing so with the object of receiving monetary pay. You are rendering this service because it provides you with ways and means of exercising, developing, and making stronger the aggressive spirit of initiative, which you must possess before you can ever become an outstanding figure in your chosen field. Those who work for money alone and who receive for their pay nothing but money are always underpaid, no matter how much they receive. Money is necessary, but the big prizes of life cannot be measured in dollars and cents. No amount of money could possibly be made to take the place of the happiness and joy and pride that belong to the person who digs a better ditch, or builds a better chicken coop, or sweeps a cleaner floor, or cooks a better meal. Every normal person loves to create something that is better than the average. The joy of creating a work of art is a joy that cannot be replaced by money or any other form of material possession. I employ a woman who opens, sorts, and answers much of my personal mail. She began in my employ more than 3 years ago. Then her duties were to take dictation. Her salary was about the same as that which others receive for similar service. One day I dictated the following motto that I asked her to type for me. "Remember that your only limitation is the one that you set up in your own mind." As she handed the typewritten page back to me, she said, "Your motto has given me an idea that is going to be of value to both you and me." I told her I was glad to have been of service to her. The incident made no particular impression on my mind, but from that day on I could see that it had made a tremendous impression on her mind. She began to come back to the office after supper and perform service that she was neither paid for nor expected to perform. Without anyone telling her to do it, she began to bring to my desk letters that she had answered for me. She had studied my style, and these letters were attended to as well as I could have done it, in some instances much better. She kept up this habit until my personal secretary resigned. When I began to look for someone to take his place, what was more natural than to turn to this young woman to fill the place? Before I had time to give her the position, she took it on her initiative. My personal mail began to come to my desk with a new secretary's name attached, and she was that secretary. On her own time, after hours, without additional pay, she had prepared herself for the best position on my staff. But that is not all. She became so noticeably efficient that she began to attract the attention of others who offered her attractive positions. I have increased her salary many times, and she now receives four times what she earned when she first went to work for me as a stenographer. And, to tell you the truth, I am helpless in the matter, because she has made herself so valuable to me that I cannot get along without her. That is initiative transformed into practical, understandable terms. I would be remiss in my duties if I failed to direct your attention to an advantage, other than a greatly increased salary, that this young lady's initiative has brought her. It has developed in her a spirit of cheerfulness that brings her happiness that most stenographers never know. Her work is not work. It is a great, interesting game at which she is playing. Even though she arrives at the office ahead of the other stenographers and remains there long after they have watched the clock tick off 5 o'clock and quitting time, her hours are shorter by far than those of the other workers. Hours of labor do not drag on the hands of those who are happy at their work. This brings us to the next step in our description of the exact procedure that you must follow in developing initiative. Inspire others. The only way to get happiness is by giving it away to others. The same applies to the development of initiative. It is a well-known fact that a man learns best that which he endeavors to teach others. If a person embraces a certain faith, the first thing he does is to go out and try to sell it to others. And in exact proportion to the extent to which he impresses others, does he impress himself. In the field of salesmanship, it is a well-known fact that no salesman is successful in selling others until he has first made a good job of selling himself. Stated conversely, no salesman can do his best to sell others without sooner or later selling himself that which he is trying to sell to others. Any statement that a person repeats over and over again for the purpose of inducing others to believe it, he will also come to believe, and this holds good whether the statement is false or true. You can now see the advantage of making it your business to talk initiative, think initiative, eat initiative, sleep initiative, and practice initiative. By doing so, you are becoming a person of initiative and leadership. For it is a well-known fact that people will readily, willingly, and voluntarily follow the person who shows by his actions that he is a person of initiative. In the place where you work, or the community in which you live, you come in contact with other people. Make it your business to interest every one of them who will listen to you in the development of initiative. It will not be necessary for you to give your reasons for doing this, nor will it be necessary for you to announce the fact that you are doing it. Just go ahead and do it. In your own mind, you will understand, of course, that you are doing it because this practice will help you, and will, at least, do those whom you influence in the same practice no harm. If you wish to try an experiment that will prove both interesting and profitable to you, pick out some person of your acquaintance whom you know to be a person who never does anything that he is not expected to do, and begin selling him your idea of initiative. Do not stop by merely discussing the subject once. Keep it up every time you have a convenient opportunity. Approach the subject from a different angle each time. If you go at this experiment in a tactful and forceful manner, you will soon observe a change in the person on whom you're trying to experiment. And you will observe something else of more importance still. You will observe a change in yourself. Do not fail to try this experiment. You cannot talk initiative to others without developing a desire to practice it yourself. Through the operation of the principle of autosuggestion, every statement that you make to others leaves its imprint on your own subconscious mind, and this holds good whether your statements are false or true. You have often heard the saying, "He who lives by the sword will die by the sword." Properly interpreted, This simply means that we are constantly attracting to ourselves and weaving into our own characters and personalities those qualities that our influence is helping to create in others. If we help others develop the habit of initiative, we, in turn, develop this same habit. If we sow the seeds of hatred and envy and discouragement in others, we, in turn, develop these qualities in ourselves. We come now to the next step in our description of the exact procedure that you must follow in developing initiative and leadership. Leadership and teamwork. Before we go further, let it be understood what is meant by the term leadership, as it is used in connection with this course on the Law of Success. There are two brands of leadership, and one of them is as deadly and destructive as the other is helpful and constructive. The deadly brand, which leads not to success but to absolute failure, is the brand adopted by pseudo-leaders who force their leadership on unwilling followers. Napoleon Bonaparte was a leader, there can be no doubt about this, but he led his followers and himself to destruction. It is not Napoleon's brand of leadership that is recommended in this course, although I will admit that Napoleon possessed all the necessary fundamentals for great leadership, excepting one. He lacked the spirit of helpfulness to others as an objective. His desire for leadership was based solely upon self-aggrandizement. His desire for leadership was built upon personal ambition and not upon the desire to lift the French people to a higher and nobler station in the affairs of nations. Editor's Commentary. As was noted in Volume 1 of The Law of Success, Napoleon Hill often cited Napoleon Bonaparte because when Hill was composing this work in 1927, his namesake was thought to be the personification of charismatic but misguided leadership. At that time, the world had yet to experience Hitler or Stalin, not to mention the many other dictators, strongmen, cult leaders, terrorists, and fanatics who ruthlessly abused their positions of power throughout the later years of the 20th century and the beginning of the new millennium. Returning to Napoleon Hill's original text. The brand of leadership that is recommended throughout this course is the brand that leads to self-determination and freedom and self-development and enlightenment and justice. This is the brand that endures. For example, and as a contrast with the brand of leadership through which Napoleon raised himself into prominence, consider our own American commoner Lincoln. The object of Lincoln's leadership was to bring truth and justice and understanding to the people of the United States. Even though he died a martyr to his belief in this brand of leadership, his name has been engraved upon the heart of the world in terms of loving kindliness that brings good to the world. Both Lincoln and Napoleon led armies in warfare, but the objects of their leadership were as different as night is different from day. Your own ability to look around and analyze people who take the leading parts in all lines of endeavor is sufficient to enable you to pick out the Lincoln as well as the Napoleon types. Your own judgment will help you decide which type you prefer to emulate. There can be no doubt in your mind as to the brand of leadership that I recommend, and there should be no question in your mind as to which of the two brands described you will adopt as your brand. I make no recommendations on this subject. However, for the reason that this course has been prepared as a means of laying before its students the fundamental principles upon which power is developed, and not as a preachment on ethical conduct, I present both the constructive and the destructive possibilities of the principles outlined in this course, that you may become familiar with both. But I leave entirely to your own discretion the choice and application of these principles, believing that your own intelligence will guide you to make a wise selection. The price of leadership. The following statement was included by Napoleon Hill, with the compliments of the Cadillac Motor Car Company. In every field of human endeavor, he that is first must perpetually live in the white light of publicity. Whether the leadership be vested in a man or in a manufactured product, emulation and envy are ever at work. In art, in literature, in music, in industry, the reward and the punishment are always the same. The reward is widespread recognition, the punishment, fierce denial and detraction. When a man's work becomes a standard for the whole world, it also becomes a target for the shafts of the envious few. If his work be merely mediocre, he will be left severely alone. If he achieves a masterpiece, it will set a million tongues a-wagging. Jealousy does not protrude its forked tongue at the artist who produces a commonplace painting. Whatsoever you write, or paint, or play, or sing, or build, No one will strive to surpass or slander you unless your work be stamped with the seal of a genius. Long, long after a great work or a good work has been done, those who are disappointed or envious continue to cry out that it cannot be done. The statement from Cadillac ended there, and Hill resumed writing as follows. The leader is assailed because he is a leader, and the effort to equal him is merely added proof of his leadership. Failing to equal or to excel, the follower seeks to depreciate and to destroy, but only confirms the superiority of that which he strives to supplant. There is nothing new in this. It is as old as the world and as old as the human passions, envy, fear, greed, ambition, and the desire to surpass, and it all avails nothing. Spiteful little voices in the domain of art were raised against the painter Whistler long after the big world acclaimed him its greatest artistic genius. Multitudes worship at the musical shrine of the composer Wagner, while the little group of those whom he had dethroned and displaced argued angrily that he was no musician at all. The little world continued to protest that the inventor Fulton could never build a steamboat, while the big world flocked to the riverbanks to see his boat steam by. Small, narrow voices cried out that Henry Ford would not last another year. But above and beyond the din of their childish prattle, Ford went silently about his business and made himself the richest and most powerful man on earth. Mean voices were raised against me, personally, before the ink was dry on the first copies of The Law of Success. Poisoned pens were released against both my ideas and me the moment the first edition of the course was printed. But if the leader truly leads, he remains the leader. Master poet, master painter, master workman, each in his own turn is assailed, and each holds his laurels through the ages. That which is good or great makes itself known no matter how loud the clamor of denial. A real leader cannot be slandered or damaged by lies of the envious, because all such attempts serve only to turn the spotlight on his ability, and real ability always finds a generous following. Attempts to destroy real leadership is love's labor lost, because that which deserves to live, lives. Cooperation. We come back now to the discussion of the third step of the procedure that you must follow in developing initiative and leadership. This third step takes us back for a review of the principle of organized effort as described in Volume 1 of The Law of Success, The Principles of Self-Mastery. You have already learned that no one can accomplish enduring results of a far-reaching nature without the aid and cooperation of others. You have already learned that when two or more persons ally themselves in any undertaking, in a spirit of harmony and understanding, each person in the alliance thereby multiplies his own powers of achievement. Nowhere is this principle more evidenced than in an industry or business in which there is perfect teamwork between the employer and the employees. Wherever you find this teamwork, you find prosperity and goodwill on both sides. Without it, prosperity suffers. Cooperation is said to be the most important word in the English language. It plays an important part in the affairs of the home, in the relationship of a man and wife, parents and children. It plays an important part in the affairs of state. So important is this principle of cooperation that no leader can become powerful or last long who does not understand and apply it in his leadership. Lack of cooperation has destroyed more business enterprises than have all other causes combined. In my 25 years of active business experience and observation, I have witnessed the destruction of all manner of business enterprises because of dissension and lack of application of this principle of cooperation. In the practice of law, I have observed the destruction of homes and divorce cases without end as a result of the lack of cooperation between man and wife. In the study of the histories of nations, it has become alarmingly obvious that lack of cooperative effort has been a curse to the human race throughout the ages. Turn back the pages of these histories and study them, and you will learn a lesson in cooperation that will impress itself indelibly upon your mind for ages and ages to come. You are paying, and your children and your children's children will continue to pay for the cost of waging wars because nations have not yet learned that a part of the world cannot suffer without damage and suffering to the whole world. This same rule applies, with telling effect, in the conduct of modern business and industry. When an industry becomes disorganized and torn asunder by strikes and other forms of disagreement, both the employers and employees suffer irreparable loss. But the damage does not stop here. This loss becomes a burden to the public and takes on the form of higher prices and scarcity of the necessities of life. In the final analysis, it becomes obvious that the evils of government and of industry have grown out of lack of cooperation. From the editors. There was a time in this country when businesses flourished and great fortunes were made by their owners, while the common laborers who toiled in factories made a pittance. It was hardly surprising that labor unions sprang up to represent those at the bottom. The United States went through many decades of unrest as labor and capital struggled with each other to achieve a balance between the interests of both parties. Ultimately, the hard-won cooperation between the two sides benefited everyone as a demand for products increased, and so did worker output. America became the world's greatest industrial power, enjoying a standard of living that was the envy of the world. The so-called captains of industry would have been reduced to failures if they had not cooperated with those they led. You, too, must learn to inspire cooperation among everyone you work with. Otherwise, it will be forced upon you or you will be forced out of your position of leadership. If you would be a real leader, you must realize that everyone in the world will not share your ambitions. Some people will oppose you directly. Others will agree with you in small ways, and still others will say, "Yes, that is a worthwhile goal, but I would go about it another way." The key is to find those points on which your interests intersect with those around you, and to use those points as a means of moving forward. You may eventually part ways with some or most of your followers, but if you have been an effective leader, they will all go their own way, feeling that they benefited from their association with you. Resuming Napoleon Hill's original text. Nor can it be truthfully said that all the evils of the world are confined to the affairs of state and industry. Take a look at the churches, and you will observe the damaging effects of lack of cooperation. No particular church is cited, but analyze any church or group of churches where lack of coordination of effort prevails, and you will see evidence of disintegration that limits the service those churches could render. My complaint is not against the work that the churches have done, but the work that they could have done through leadership that was based upon the principle of coordinated, cooperative effort that would have carried civilization at least 1,000 years ahead of where it is today. These possibilities are not mentioned in a spirit of criticism, but only as a means of illustrating the power of cooperation, and to emphasize my belief in the potential power of the churches of the world. Had it not been for the influence of the churches, no one would be safe in walking down the street. People would be at each other's throats like wolves, and civilization would still be in the prehistoric age. Through harmonized effort and through cooperation, the churches of the world could wield sufficient influence to render war an impossibility. It is not yet too late for such leadership. Commentary from the editors. Since the first publication of The Law of Success in the early part of the 20th century, there have been profound changes in practically every aspect of our way of life. Yet none of those changes have made Hill's basic concepts less relevant or his advice less applicable. In fact, as has been said before, many of the changes came about because of the influence of Napoleon Hill's philosophy on those who have become the leaders in every aspect of American life. The last quarter of the 20th century saw the emergence of a subset within the publishing industry that specializes in books and audiobooks on personal growth, motivation, leadership, and management style, all of which are testament to the enduring quality of the principles enunciated in the Law of Success. Many of these recent books became the biggest bestsellers of their day, and in them you will find Napoleon Hill's ideas, elaborated upon, personalized, and told from different perspectives that will further illuminate the principles you are learning in these pages. The editors of this volume suggest that when you have finished listening to all 4 volumes of The Law of Success, you should then read or listen to the audiobook of Hill's classic, Think and Grow Rich, followed by reading or listening to the work of others who have explored the same ground. The following list is a sampling of books that are also available on audio. The editors feel confident that you will find these similarly enlightening. You Can Negotiate Anything by Herb Cohen. The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen R. Covey. Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway by Susan Jeffers. In Search of Excellence by Tom Peters. Awaken the Giant Within by Anthony Robbins. and the complete Anthony Robbins library of Power Talk audiobooks. Wishcraft by Barbara Scher, Do What You Love, The Money Will Follow by Marsha Sinitar, and Sell Your Way to the Top by Zig Ziglar.